In the world of politics and foreign affairs, there are the names that you know, but they bring with them a hidden fact. None of them are all-knowing. They are informed and guided by information and insight by people that they have placed in positions of trust and responsibility. My next guest with his new best-selling book presents the stories of these hidden individuals who, through their conclusions and guidance, crafted what has pretty much been American foreign and war policies since 1947. His book is White House Warriors, How the National Security Council Transformed the American Way of War. He is a former chief Pentagon speechwriter, currently director of communications and research with the University of Pennsylvania's Global Policy Institute, Perry World House. Dr. John Gans, how are you today, sir?
I'm good. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Well, thank you for writing this book, because I think in just not the current affairs, but when you think back at any point in life, if you're an observer of things that were happening in the world, White House Warriors adds content to the missing pieces of what a person's understanding is. John's on Twitter, by the way, at John Gans, J-R, and you can keep on top of his observations as well as other things he sees worthy of value. What was the initial intent, and how did the National Security Council come to be?
Well, so the National Security Council was created after World War II. I always like to point out to people that Franklin Roosevelt didn't need a National Security Staff or a National Security Council to win World War II, but everybody in Washington thought he did, because Franklin Roosevelt ran World War II basically out of the Oval Office with just a handful of aides and people he trusted. So, and he liked to say he liked to juggle. He was a juggler, he said, and he liked to mislead and lie to people around him in order to keep everybody sort of on edge and to keep everybody out of the loop. The problem with that is that, you know, the war was pretty scary, right? It was a two-front global war against empires and empires in the making. You know, Franklin Roosevelt was an older man who had obviously been sick and had some health issues, and the government was getting bigger, right? And it was getting much stronger. And you know, as I like to point out, the Pentagon was built during World War II while we were fighting the war. Like, that giant building was built, so it was filling itself up. It was getting bigger, and so everybody kind of thought juggling is no way to run an army, run a country, run a war. And so government, all of the bureaucracy basically said, after the war was won and Roosevelt had passed away, said, listen, we gotta get control of this. And so they created this National Security Council, which was basically a group of the biggest names in national security. So it was Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, Vice President, President, and a few others. And they basically said, we're going to sit them all in a room and they're going to make decisions together. And Congress said, listen, that's a good idea, but we need somebody to help make sure that all these people show up on time, know what they're talking about, and we know what they say. So they created, in one line of law, a staff that was basically an administrative secretarial staff. And from those humble beginnings, from that sort of just one line of law and a handful of secretarial staff, people who are just taking notes, grew an institution in the heart of government that sits in the executive office building next to the White House. And it's almost a 400-person staff that works for John Bolton, who's the National Security Advisor today. And these individuals, most people have never heard of them, and they have shaped the world we live in by shaping every war that we've fought from Truman administration to the Trump administration, from Korea to Afghanistan. And so what I tried to do is both expose them to a little bit of analysis, but also introduce them to the world and help the American people hear their war stories.
How much material, concrete material, was there to work with? Were they proficient note keepers, file keepers? Material did you have to work with?
So the good news is that because they were sort of in charge of keeping the records, they kept the records. The problem is that a lot of this stuff is just hidden in classifications and secrecy and rules that make it hard for people to see. So what I had to do is I had to dig very, very deep, and I had to spend a lot of time in the archives and get stuff declassified. So I traveled to, I think, 9 archives around the country, the Reagan Library and Nixon Library in California, Texas, everywhere, to different archives. And then I had to spend a lot of time interviewing people. And so I looked at something like 10,000 documents, which was great. So looking in their files, and I would see their memos that were then written up and annotated by the president they were working for. I found the memo that was written by the staff to George H.W. Bush, the first Bush, about how the war in Iraq was going to kind of come to a messy, inconclusive end. And he sort of circled a few of the lines and said yes next to them in his and his marker. So I found these papers, and then I just spent time talking to everybody who would talk to me about it. And so I spoke to 12 national security advisors, including H.R. McMaster, and then, you know, people like Vice President Dick Cheney, who gave me a ton of time, and mostly because people wanted to tell the story of the staff. Now, it's not a rosy picture in all circumstances, but most people in government appreciated that this was a story that needed to be told because too few Americans understand how their government works and how national security policy is made.
The layperson will probably think when it comes to the National Security Council, oh, yeah, that's staffed by a bunch of head nodders because the president wants people who will agree with him or her, and nothing. There'll be no significant difference. It's going to vary from president to president, obviously, but as far as the staffing, how was it cut and divided, and what were the type of people that were searched for to be part of the NSC?
Yeah, well, it was funny. What I would say about the NSC is that I think a lot of people just assume that, you know, that when the boss says something, the staff does it, right? That's what everybody thinks. But I always try to explain to people that, you know, the national security business isn't that different from whatever you do for a living, whether it's, you know, working at a bank, working on a construction site, working at a school, whatever you do, right? You're going to have, you know, moments where you like your boss and moments where you don't like your boss. You're going to have moments where you think you know better than your boss, and you're going to have moments where your boss says, I don't know what to do. Tell me what to do, right? And so it's a much more of a give-and-take situation. The second thing is that national security is something that is going on all the time. People are worried about it all the time and working on it all the time. And this country faces issues, threats, and challenges 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, right? And so the president only has so much time. So what I always like to say is that the president's usually have very strong instincts on policy, and some of them have very strong opinions about particular policies. But in many cases, you know, they're learning and getting deeper into the weeds as the sort of events unfold. And so the staff is both there shaping their understanding of the issues and shaping their opinions about the options that the country has to sort of respond, right? So, you know, I tell the story in the book of a young staffer in her 30s, a woman named Megan O'Sullivan, who was the person, really, one of the first and only people in government that said to George W. Bush, we've got to do a surge in Iraq. And she said it very early in 2006. And nobody in government really wanted to hear that. And she sort of said, listen, this is the situation is turning. I'm giving you the information and telling you this. We need to move on and get a new decision out today or as soon as possible. I need to get troops there as soon as possible. And so she basically helped shape how President Bush came to decide on the surge. She shaped the policy that he ended up deciding upon. And then she went to Iraq and actually went and helped, you know, work as the surge sort of took hold and slowly started to turn the game around in Iraq for a time being. And so what you see is that it's not that George W. Bush made the decision, and George W. Bush was obviously interested in winning the war, but he didn't know how to do it. You know, I mean, all of us remember Iraq, right? We all remember what it was like and how frustrating and depressing and how it seemed for almost 2 or 3 years like nobody knew what to do. And George W. Bush got there, and in the first few pages of the book, I tell the story about the day he basically decided to make the surge decision. It was Megan O'Sullivan sitting in the office alone with him. And so I think that's a piece of this that I think people need to appreciate and need to appreciate that, you know, very often there aren't good options on these things. And the staff tries to help find the best option possible.
With John Gans with his new book, White House Warriors, How the National Security Council Transformed the American Way of War. Here are on Issues and Ideas. Another person you give a much-deserved light on, and this story alone could be a movie. I mean, your whole book could be turned into a political-based film, but the story of Nelson Drew on its own is worthy of a film because of just the dedication he had, the sacrifice he made, and what he wound up as a legacy of what he left behind.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. Nelson Drew is one of those people that everybody should know about, but nobody does. And in part, that's because he sort of wanted it that way. Nelson Drew was sort of a classic behind-the-scenes guy, right? He was a young student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and, you know, Vietnam was going on, and he said he wanted to finish school, he needed the money, and he joined ROTC, and he joined the Air Force ROTC. And he got an Air Force ROTC and got and graduated and was getting ready to sort of go try to be a pilot, but it turned out his eyesight was terrible. And so they basically said, well, you have two options. You can get out or you can go become an intelligence officer. And he became an intelligence officer, and sort of another twist of fate landed him in Germany, where he was sitting in Germany. And in the old days, the United States military sort of covered the Middle East from Europe. And he's sitting in Germany during the Iranian Revolution in 1979, and he didn't know Farsi, didn't know the languages that you needed to study the Middle East. So his supervisor basically said, well, why don't you go look at Yugoslavia, you know, like keeping him busy. And he ended up jumping into it, digging deep, learning about the culture, learning about everything going on. And he became sort of the recognized expert on Yugoslavia in the Air Force. And, you know, not really a tremendously useful thing in the middle of the Cold War. I mean, Yugoslavia was one of many challenges, but it wasn't the hot button issue at the time. And so he basically went on, got his PhD, went and taught at the Air Force Academy, and he gets sent back to Europe at the right around the end of the Cold War, and what happens? Yugoslavia starts to melt down. And so he becomes one of the sort of key people in Brussels at the start of the Balkans and Bosnia and all these sort of terrible, where all these terrible atrocities are going on. And eventually gets sent back to Washington, and one day he's walking through Washington, and an old friend of his who worked at the White House saw him at a meeting and took one of those little coasters that comes under water glasses and wrote, hey, I want you to come over and work with me at the White House. And Drew was like, this was his dream, right? He had been working on policy issues for years and had always dreamed of working at the White House. And he jumped at the chance, and he went into the White House and worked and worked and worked and pulled all-nighters and came, and he and another colleague, at a time when Bosnia looked lost, right, where there's, you know, 8,000 people were killed in 1 week, and just terrible, terrible, terrible things were going on, and President Clinton was asking everybody for ideas, and he couldn't find any that worked. And finally, Nelson Drew and his colleague, a gentleman named Sandy Virchow, an ambassador, wrote an idea down, and President Clinton said, this is, all right, well, let's give it a shot. And he gave the mission, the diplomatic piece of it, to a guy named Richard Holbrooke, who's back in the news because there's a big book about Richard Holbrooke in the news. And Richard Holbrooke had basically given up on the policy. He said no, the United States couldn't figure it out and Clinton couldn't make a decision. But Nelson Drew had kept going on it. And because the White House didn't trust Richard Holbrooke that much, they sent Nelson Drew on his plane on these historic shuttle missions to kind of go around and try and convince the various warring parties in Bosnia to sort of come to peace talks. And on their first trip, Nelson Drew was riding in a car with a few other gentlemen, and it spun out on a sort of a steep cliff coming back from a meeting with Slobodan Milosevic, who I'm sure some of your listeners remember. Sure. And the car rolled down the mountain and exploded. And Nelson Drew and these two other colleagues passed away. They died on the side of the mountain. But Nelson Drew was the only NSC staffer to ever die in the line of duty. And Holbrooke went on, was sort of fortified by this tragedy, and went on to sort of get everybody come to peace talks at the Dayton peace talks in 1995, and eventually come to the Dayton peace accords that brought some peace to that to the Balkans. But it wouldn't have happened without Nelson Drew, and he's one of many staffers, and his war story is one of many that I talk about in the books that American people should know, because I think they would feel better about their public servants if they knew people like Nelson Drew were on the job right now in Washington.
Yeah, we certainly have a negative opinion of insiders in D.C., but there are people who have merit and are there with the dedication to make a difference. Of course, you also get the stories of the Henry Kissingers and Colin Powells, how their managerial styles impacted the NSC, contentious times like the Vietnam War era, how that played a role in how the NSC acted and interacted with the White House. A couple of seconds left here. Could a member of the 1960s NSC be dropped into 2019 and serve as well?
That's a good question. I mean, I think my hunch is that they probably could. I mean, you know, it's funny. I mean, I spoke to, as I mentioned, like almost, did about 100 interviews for this book. And I spoke to people from the 60s. I mean, I spoke to some people who served in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations who are still around and still, you know, doing their things. I mean, Henry Kissinger is still around writing op-eds. So there's plenty of these folks who are still around. And what I would say is that in some ways, that as much as the world changes and as much as technology has changed everything we do, but especially national security, right? You can basically, National Security Council staffers can have a top secret video teleconference with anybody on Earth right now. It's pretty amazing technology. But in general, the job really hasn't changed that much. It's thinking about the world. It's trying to be able to sort of write it and condense it into a sort of understandable prose. It's being able to come up with options. And I, as I say in the book, there's not really any new ideas in war, right? There's more troops, less troops. These aren't new ideas. And to an extent, it's about trying to convince your colleagues to do things. So in some ways, the job hasn't changed that much. So I think for sure, these 60 folks could easily go in. I think Michael Forrestal, who I talked about in the Kennedy administration, he was an old friend of Kennedy's who came down and went on his NSC and ended up, despite his admitting he had no East Asia experience and no Asia experience whatsoever, basically being Kennedy's point person on Vietnam and helped inform and drive some of the decisions that deepened our involvement in that war. And, you know, he could just as easily be sitting on the Trump or the Obama NSCs, no question, no doubt about it. He probably would have liked it, because in fact the staff has basically been institutionally empowered and put in a much greater position today than it was 50, 60 years ago. He had to be a little bit trickier back then when he was trying to get things done. Now he would just have the opportunity to sort of argue for the ideas at the table, because president after president has given these staffers a great deal of power.
The book is White House Warriors, How the National Security Council Transformed the American Way of War. John is on Twitter at John Gans, J-R. John Gans, thanks so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me on. Great to talk to you.